Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com.
When 18-year-old Richard Thompson joined Fairport Convention in 1967, it was his guitar chops that got the band signed to a label. Almost half a century later, he's still feeling it.
I like this song because it's about lusting old people.
Which you can feel.
Well, I can. Well, we're still randy old bastards, you know.
The young at heart, Richard Thompson plays songs from his terrific new album, Electric. And after a winter of big bad storms all over the country, spring is finally on the horizon. We're looking ahead to this season with a new extra credit challenge, Remixing Spring. So let's drop a beat on that. We provide the amazing archive of Birdsong. You provide the remix. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to five individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Oh, one, two, three.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It's not every day you get to sit down with a guitar god, so when you do, it's best to take advantage of the situation. Which is why I didn't just ask Richard Thompson to play us a few songs and talk. I asked him to write a musical score for this edition of the show. All the interstitial music you'll hear today, he composed and performed live just for us. I'll talk to the legendary folk rocker later in this hour. But first, what do you do when one of your favorite artists turns out to be a white supremacist and Holocaust denier? That's exactly what's happening right now in the art world in the Pacific Northwest, especially Seattle. I'm talking about the well-known sculptor and painter Charles Kraft, who's 65 years old. He's always been something of a provocateur, known for his ceramic work, like an AK-47 made of porcelain and a China teapot in the shape of Hitler's head. The story about Kraft broke a few weeks ago in The Stranger, a weekly in Seattle. Jen Graves is the paper's visual arts writer.
You know, about 6 months ago, a reader just wrote in anonymously and said, "Is Charles Kraft a Holocaust denier?" I thought, I don't know, well, I'll ask him. So I immediately emailed him and just said, somebody wrote this in and maybe they have an axe to grind, but I'd like to know. And he wrote back to say, whoever asked you that does not have my best interests at heart. And unless it pertains to my art or something you're writing about, I'm not going to answer. At which point I thought, that's crazy. Why wouldn't you just say, you know, no?
Graves continued emailing with Kraft to clarify his views, and she quotes from that exchange.
"Do you believe Hitler's regime systematically murdered millions of Jews?" Quote. Kraft wrote back, quote, "I don't doubt that Hitler's regime killed a lot of Jews in World War II, but I don't believe they were ever frog-marched into homicidal gas chambers and dispatched."
Kraft's pieces are in collections around the country, including the Seattle Art Museum and the De Young in San Francisco. Tim Detweiler is a longtime arts consultant and curator in Seattle. Most recently, he served as executive director of the Museum of Northwest Art. Tim, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
So Kraft, it turns out, has made some pretty insanely out there statements. He appeared on a white supremacist podcast on a website called The White Network and said, among other things, "I believe the Holocaust is a myth." What was your first reaction when you heard about this side of Kraft coming out?
For me personally, I honestly thought it was a part of his
performance that was connected to his work. We have been looking at his work for a long time, and the understanding is that, you know, he's taking something really powerful and horrible, and he's making it into ceramics with blue flowers painted around it. And he's been saying for years and years that it was ironic, that it was anti-fascist. So it pretty much turned my head spinning a little bit.
I can imagine. And it really does go to the heart of what we've thought about a lot of art for the last 100 years or so, which is to say it is what the artist intends. The intentions are everything, not necessarily the object. And now that he has come out as a true believer in this, it entirely changes the nature of his pieces, yeah?
I believe so. I mean, I think that especially artists who are working in this way, you know, I see a correlation between Kara Walker's work and Charlie Kraft's work. You know, artists that use racial imagery to kind of draw out this darkness, you know, out into the light. You know, Fred Wilson, Roger Shimomura, they have a special burden that a landscape painter doesn't really have, where their intention and the reasons that they do it really make a big difference.
You ran the Museum of Northwest Art, which has some of his work in the collection. What should they do? I mean, what is the responsibility of an institution in a case like this? Or maybe it's unprecedented, but what ought they to do with the pieces they own?
Well, the museum doesn't own any of these particular pieces. This is one part of his work.
Right.
But, you know, museums have a role to play in our society, and it's a long-term role. It's a role where we, you know, keep things for a long, long time, and they rarely are reactionary as far as, you know, getting rid of works. And so, you know, if there was a piece of his on permanent collection, obviously the most important thing would be to write a really long label that explains everything that's going on. And, you know, if I had a show of Charlie's work right now and this came out during the run of it, the best thing that a museum could do is have a panel and try to educate people as to how this changes things and get comments from as many experts as possible.
When he made this work of bust of Hitler and so forth, when it was presumed to be, and he said it was ironic, the art world took it as one thing, this acceptable, provocative statement about kitsch and horrors. Now that we see it in this entirely different light, clearly the meaning of the work and all that changes. But if people thought it was good work 2 months ago, is it still interesting work?
Maybe to a new audience, unfortunately. Basically, I think Kara Walker said it best. She said, you know, this isn't easy work to look at. It never has been. If it is, then there's a problem. And so I think that in some ways, this shines a light on our ability to kind of look at something and pass it off lightly. But at the same time, I think that when you are making an elemental, you know, statement about your work, that it is saying one thing politically, and then you flip that meaning publicly, you know, this is self-proclaimed. This isn't just our interpretation of it.
Yep.
And then that new interpretation has to be taken strongly into account. This is a story that's unfolding, and I think that, you know, with most things, we have much more clarity as things go along. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're not really pissed off.
Right.
It doesn't mean that at the moment, you know, I feel like someone kicked me in the stomach.
Right.
But, you know, as museum professionals, we have to look, you know, kind of down the long road and try to get some perspective on this. And that's what I hope we can do more and more.
Indeed so. Tim Detweiler, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Tim Detweiler is an arts consultant and curator in Seattle. You can see images of the Charles Kraft works we mentioned on our website, studio360.org. Tell us what you think. Should museums keep displaying Kraft's work now that he's made these statements? Go to our website and leave a comment. Whether you've spent your winter dealing with monster storms or just wearing a couple extra layers, chances are you are looking forward to spring. Trees budding, flowers blooming, and then there are the birds. If you can't wait for the real thing, right now you can enjoy some exquisite springtime sounds with a set of headphones. Cornell University has just finished digitizing their entire collection of animal sounds, 150,000 animal sounds assembled over the last century. And they've got an especially vast and intriguing collection of bird song. For our new extra credit challenge, we're asking you to use those bird songs, any of them, for remixing spring. Joining me to talk about this feast of natural sounds is Cornell University's Greg Budney. He's the curator of audio at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. A pleasure to be here.
So 150,000 sounds. How many hours does that comprise?
Approximately 7,500 hours of listening.
So why was this undertaken? Was it for biologists or because they're cool and civilians like me should have access to all these cool sounds?
For all of the above, the primary users of the archive are researchers, but the resources are available to anybody. And for anyone with an interest in nature, sound is a phenomenal tool for opening up the wonder of the natural world. If you know what something sounds like, you can find it. Your range of detection is so much greater, and you can focus on the species or the creature that's of greatest interest to you, really optimize your time in the field.
That's interesting. So it's like a language course. Before you go out in the field, you can really immerse yourself into what this species or that species is going to sound like when you get to the wild.
Exactly.
Well, let's listen to a few of the sounds in this vast collection. What do we have first?
First up is a Swainson's thrush.
Where would one find that?
Woodlands in North America. You could find it all across the northern latitudes in the Sierra Nevada of California, the Rocky Mountains at upper elevation. Characteristic sound of a beautiful forest. This species of thrush has a very distinctive upward spiral. And these spring peeper-like frog notes.
I hear some bugs as well in there.
Yes, there are.
The thing about this sound and all these sounds is it does this amazing thing of putting me there. I mean, I can almost smell the pine and feel the breeze. The next one I think you're going to play is one of my favorites that I've heard. This is what?
This is a common loon. And what we're going to hear is the wail, which is a long-distance communication vocalization given between a mated pair of birds when they're out of sight of one another and they're trying to establish contact. It's essentially, here I am, where are you? Now, one would expect to hear a distant response at this point, but the mate isn't having it. Perhaps they had a little squabble earlier on.
Which makes it even more sad. I literally, every time that sound comes, I am getting goosebumps as I listen. So, Greg, you have kindly picked out about a dozen different bird songs of the tens of thousands in the database, and we have posted them online where listeners can download them and use one or more of them as part of an original musical composition. Any genre based on the theme of spring. So composers, you've got 3 weeks to come up with your piece. Your deadline is March 17th at midnight, and we will announce the winners the first weekend of spring. Greg, you'll come back to help us pick the best ones?
It would be my great pleasure.
And there's nobody more familiar than you with the nature of birdsong. Do you have any advice for our composers?
Well, there's one essential fact about our songbirds that might provide some inspiration. That is the organ that they use for sound production. It's called the syrinx, and it sits at the junction of the two bronchial tubes. You could think of it as two voice boxes And each voice box is capable of independently producing a sound, or the two boxes can act in unison to create a single sound. And if you slow the sounds down, you can often hear the overlapping signals being produced by either side of this remarkable organ.
That's really interesting. So they really are the first two-track devices in some way.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I like that analogy.
Excellent. Greg Budney is the curator of audio at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You can get the details about our Remixing Spring contest at studio360.org. And here is a little remix of sorts. Richard Thompson playing in our studio, accompanied by the sounds of the song thrush, or the throstle, as they call it in England, Richard Thompson's homeland. Still ahead right now in Studio 360, a smart new play about Isaac Newton that ditches the old apple dropping on the head bit for some more provocative truths.
There's something theatrically exciting about seeing somebody on stage with a needle stuck into their eye.
The playwright behind Isaac's Eye, ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Most plays about historical events and figures take liberties with the facts. You probably couldn't write a good play if you didn't do that. But I've never seen one that handles the mix of fact and fiction quite like Lucas Naith's new play about Isaac Newton. It's set when the scientist is a young man, practically a kid, working out his theories in provincial obscurity. And it begins with an actor addressing the audience.
Isaac Newton knew, or thought he knew, there was something called ether. He thought there was ether everywhere. Ether in the air, ether in between the air, ether everywhere there was a there. And because he thought there was ether everywhere, it helped him imagine how things moved. He could imagine that things moved on ether, in his head. That's how things moved. We know now what Newton did not know then. There is no such thing as ether. But by believing that ether was real, Isaac was able to see things he could not have seen, if he did not think that there was something there that was not really there. This play is filled with ether. There are things in this play that are not true. There are also things that are true, lots of things, even things that are true that don't sound true, but are true. Like, when Isaac Newton was a kid, he threatened to burn down his house and kill his parents. That's true. But there are also things in the play that are not true. But like ether, the lies are here to help us make sense of the things that are true. Now, because we don't want to lie to you, anything that's true we'll write on the wall. If it's not written on the wall, just know it might be made up. Isaac Newton threatened to burn down his parents' house. And that's true.
That's Jeff Beal in the opening scene from Isaac's Eye, a new play about Isaac Newton. Lucas Naith, the playwright, is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360 and congratulations for this terrific play.
Thank you, Kurt.
So you promise, as we just heard, this total transparency. All the true facts we hear about Newton and the other characters are written on the walls during the play as they come up in the course of the story. And everything else is your imagination. It is a really nice solution to the problem of historical fiction, which I've played with, and really it seems only doable in the theater. It's something theater only could do. How did you come to that device?
I had written a number of plays about celebrities or iconic figures. I'd written one about Anna Nicole Smith. I'd written one about the Clintons. And by the time I finished my play about the Clintons, I was starting to worry that I was just taking these people's stories and putting my own stories into them. That was a debate going on in my head at the time that I started writing Isaac's Eye. And so I decided, well, I'll just stage the debate. I will show the audience what's true, and I will be very upfront with the fact that I'm making stuff up. And it's my hope that by making something up, I'm able to give an interesting context for the facts.
So from Anna Nicole Smith to Isaac Newton, how did you get to Newton as a subject of the play?
I was actually listening to the Leonard Lopate show.
On WNYC.
On my iPod. I was walking home, and he was interviewing George Johnson, who wrote a book called The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments. And Johnson had actually mentioned in passing very quickly this experiment that Newton had done where he placed a needle behind his eye. And what I realized on that walk home was that there's something really theatrically exciting about seeing somebody on stage with a needle stuck into their eye.
Which you do, and which is pretty central to the plot. And for minutes, it looks as though the actor does indeed have a needle stuck in his eye. Is that a prop needle?
I'm not allowed to say what we're actually doing, except to say that it is kind of difficult what the actor Haskell is doing in that moment.
Isaac Newton, before he was Sir Isaac Newton, did stick a needle in his tear duct. How do we know that he did it and then don't know why? That doesn't follow.
He has in his diary a hand-drawn picture of an oversized hand sticking a needle into the eye, and all he writes beside it are that he saw light and dark-colored circles, and that's all we know.
It must be a very different process writing about Newton, about whom we know so relatively little, and somebody like the Clintons or Anna Nicole Smith, about whom we know way too much factually, right? Does that free the fiction streams?
Yeah, I think so, actually. With Newton, what we have coming in is this really uninteresting two-dimensional image of a person with wavy hair getting hit on the head with an apple. And so my objective was to smash that, and that's actually pretty easy to smash when that's all you have. But I kind of filled in a lot of the gaps of the play by really basing him a lot on myself, which is kind of a strange thing to admit to. But I think you could actually look at the play and change his occupation to playwright, and you can change the Royal Society to, I don't know, the MacArthur Genius Grant, and then you kind of have it there, that sort of desire to get this position in one's career where you can ostensibly do whatever you want.
And so you're blackmailed David Mamet to try to get your position in the theater?
I don't know if Mamet can help me, but there may be others.
I want to listen to another scene from the play, Isaac's Eye. In this scene, Newton is still this young genius whom nobody knows, and he's decided to send descriptions of his experiments to Robert Hooke, who was the most famous, celebrated scientist in England at the time. He wants Hooke to get him into the Royal Society, which is preposterous for this kid that nobody knows. And Hooke feels threatened by his obvious genius in these papers, and he goes to visit Newton.
You sent me this little story that you wrote about an experiment you did with light and a piece of glass.
Yeah.
It's written like a little story. I set up the beam of light like this and watched how it hit the wall, and then I took a piece of glass.
Yeah.
And then you talk about how the light hits the glass, and you say, oh, I'm so surprised. It breaks up into colors.
Yeah.
And the point you raise here is whether the glass colors the light or...
if light is all colors.
And then you go straight from there and say, okay, well, I'll pass the colored light through a second prism.
Uh-huh.
And when you did that, the colored light stayed colored.
Yeah.
Which you think means things don't color light. Light is all colors in one.
So what's the problem?
You had all these little realizations all at once. It was like that in your head. You just went from one thought to the next, one after another, just like that.
Yeah.
When did you do this?
I've been doing that type of thing for years.
But the way you wrote the story, you made it sound like it happened in one afternoon.
Yeah.
So you're saying you woke up one morning, decided to try this experiment on light, and by the time you were eating dinner...
it was a bunch of different afternoons.
Right, but you said...
yeah, I know what I said.
You know you said...
yeah, I know.
so you know the way that it's written isn't the way that it happened. I have a problem with that.
Why?
It's not accurate.
It's more clear this
way. But it's not true.
Yeah, but the basic idea still works out. It's just a technicality.
How can I trust this if you're fudging how things happened?
You can do the experiment yourself.
Yes. Yes, I can. For the points you prove using an experiment.
I've proved everything with experiments.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So in the same thing that you sent me about light, where you say light is made up of what? Little bits and pieces? That's proven? Where is that demonstrated?
Do you not believe that light is made of particles?
Nope.
That's Michael Lewis Seraphin Wells playing Robert Hooke and Haskell King as the young Isaac Newton. Other than hearing this stray fact on the radio one day, how much did you know about Newton, about the rivalry between Newton and Hooke?
After I heard that story on the radio, I started collecting a list of facts that could help point me to moments of conflict. Because my goal was to figure out, okay, I need to create a moment where Newton decides to actually do this test where he puts a needle behind his eye. And it needs to be a moment where he's willing to risk a lot. And the most obvious one was that Hooke was really critical of Newton's writings on optics. And when Hooke criticized those works pretty soon after Newton had a nervous breakdown.
And he is portrayed, your Newton, as this brilliant, hubristic kid who really is deeply awkward in the social niceties. Do you think of him as an Asperger's-y person?
I had heard the theory that Newton might have had Asperger's. I tried as much as possible to put that out of mind. It was really important for me to just show how driven he is and how he's actually making choices to remove himself from the social sphere in exchange for some greater glory. And that choice is really important to me.
And becomes essentially the takeaway from this piece.
Yeah. I mean, the play does set up a kind of false dichotomy, I think, that you can either be in this world and have love in this world, or you can remove yourself from it and have greatness beyond the grave. I mean, that's of course a false dichotomy, but it's a battle that's happening inside my mind all the time. That, you know, I when I decide to go off for a week and work on a new play and not talk to anybody, I am cutting myself off from the rest of the world, and there's something that's simultaneously painful about that. And something that I sometimes regret, but also, I mean, the thing you come out with in the end, you're really proud of it. It's nice to have made something.
And would 20 conversations and 8 beers over the course of that week have been better for you? Probably not.
Probably not.
Well, I'm eager, having seen Isaac's Eye, to see your next one and your next one. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lucas Naith is the playwright of Isaac's Eye and other plays, including Death Tax and the Courtship of Anna Nicole Smith. Every so often, we ask artists and listeners about cultural works that changed their lives. Today, Sandra Bernhard. She's touring the country right now, and if you've ever heard her sing or talk or seen her act, you really can't forget her. She's almost cartoonishly tough and irreverent, but also intensely sincere. Her breakout role came 30 years ago when Martin Scorsese cast her as an obsessed young fan who kidnaps a talk show host in The King of Comedy.
Do you like these glasses? Crystal, beautiful. I bought them just for you. I don't know, there's something about them that reminds me of just the simplicity of them. But if you don't like them, if there's even an inkling, even a doubt in your mind.
Sandra Bernhard, in real life, had her own obsession with a famous performer, a non-pathological obsession. In 1963, she saw a touring production of Hello, Dolly, starring Carol Channing. Bernhard was 8 years old.
you know, and then we got to the theater and we sat in our seats and just, like, you know, the electrifying atmosphere of the Fischer Theater was just overwhelming. And of course, then the band, you know, the orchestra strikes up the overture and you're ready to jump out of your skin. And then out walks this creature, Carol Channing, in full, you know, 1890s regalia with the head dress and the hat and the, you know, the corseted dress.
Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louis. It's so nice to be back home where I belong.
And I was just jumping out of my seat. I mean, I was near hysteria. She had this voice that, you know, was unparalleled by anybody else. It was very enchanting. I mean, that's, of course, what made her such a big star and separated her from the pack.
Going strong, I feel the room swaying, for the band's playing
one of my old favorite songs from way back when. So
bridge that gap, fellas. Find me an empty lap, fellas.
Dolly'll never go away again. And all the waiters were, you know, dancing.
Hello, darling. Well, hello, darling. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You're looking swell.
Right from the get-go, I assumed that I should be a part of the cast. Why am I not on stage here playing one of the, at least one of the supporting roles? It was just the whole experience of being in the theater and being with people that I felt were my kindred spirits, you know, that I felt I was home and where I belonged with these bigger-than-life characters. So when I saw it, you know, actually come to life on a stage with, you know, with an orchestra and sets, I was like, okay, well, I could bump it up to that easily.
Get the old girl now, fellas.
Well, one of the first times I ever came to New York, I made this sort of strange bet with myself. I said, if you see Carol Channing on this trip, that means you're going to be successful in your career. So this was probably in the 70s. And I actually did see Carol Channing crossing 57th and Madison. She was walking in front of me. And it was total kismet. I didn't bother her at the time. I hadn't really made my mark yet.
Happy together, unhappy together.
Carol was a jumping off place for me. She definitely gave me that license to say, you can just go for broke. I always felt like it was, you know, not only my gift, but it was my responsibility and still is when people come to see me to take it all the way out there, like, you know, like Carol would.
We're in and we're out of the money.
I definitely think my performance in The King of Comedy when I played Masha.
Let's do something crazy tonight. Just get insane. I want to be crazy.
Who was slightly unhinged. Was, you know, a direct descendant of Carol's performance.
Carol, I'll have a good time. You can't get crazy. See,
this character was insane and had to really just go completely crazy.
Wouldn't you like to see me out of my head? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be fabulous?
And my, you know, exposure to Carol early on gave me the license to do it. And then I think the first time I actually met her is when she came backstage to see me perform when I was doing my show, I'm Still Here, Damn It, in 1997. And she came backstage, she was wearing all white. She let her hair go natural, she wasn't wearing wigs anymore. She looked amazing, fit as a fiddle. And she literally came back, took me into her arms and said, you are my spiritual granddaughter. So I knew that I had really, you know, come full circle to be, you know, blessed by Carol Channing.
Sandra Bernhard's story was produced by Michael Rayfield. Is there some play or a movie or a song or any other work of art that changed your life when you were a kid like Sandra or when you were older? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org and we might put you on the radio. Coming up in Studio 360, musician Richard Thompson, whose name always seems to pop up next to Hendrix and Clapton and Page on all those best guitarists of all time lists. They all riffed off the American blues, while Thompson did his own thing.
It's not very bluesy, but it's more sort of Celtic. We wanted to go back to the roots of the traditional style and really revive that.
Richard Thompson is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Back in 1967, a new English folk rock band called Fairport Convention was signed to a record deal. A lot of it on the strength of its lead guitarist, Richard Thompson, who was only 18 years old. This is the first song from their first album released in the summer of 1968. It's called Time Will Show the Wiser. Forty-five years later, Richard Thompson is still performing and still writing songs and still generally regarded as one of the best guitarists alive and still making records. He has a brand new one out, and he's here with me in Studio 360's big live studio today. Richard Thompson, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So the title of this new album is Electric. You have your electric plugged in.
I do.
And you're ready to go. What can we hear first?
We're going to play a song called Stuck on the Treadmill.
Excellent.
2, 3.
But I never win. I'm stuck on the treadmill. Another day of punching steel till my arms too numb to feel. I'm like a hamster on a wheel. I'm stuck on the treadmill. Shaking sheets of metal,
time just standing here. I went to sleep, I grabbed a beer. Oh, I'm stuck on the treadmill. Me and the robot working away. He looks at me as if to say, I'll be doing your job someday. I'm stuck on the treadmill. Off 100 more, 20 years, and they show you the door. I'm stuck on the treadmill. Strikes coming, troubles brewing. The hotel's going to wreck and ruin. Next year, what'll I be doing? Stuck on the treadmill.
Great. That was Richard Thompson singing his song Stuck on the Treadmill, joined by whom on bass and drums?
We have Taras Pradanyuk on the bass and Michael Jerome on the drums.
That song has a kind of 21st century John Henry story in it, and and a very Richard Thompson lyric I love, with the reference to the robot who you've humanized and you're competing with, this robot who's going to take your job.
Yeah, well, you know, times are tough. They've been tough for the last 5-7 years, and, you know, keeping a job, finding a job, getting paid real money for a job, these have all been real issues lately. So I wanted to reflect that kind of thing in what's going on.
And is that from reading about industrial life, or do you hang with guys who work in factories?
I know some people who work in factories. I know some people who work in offices. You know, there's people working in all walks of life that I rub shoulders with, you know, and
that are treadmills, whether or not they're punching steel.
Punching steel might be a more interesting job than sitting in an office, you know.
As I suggested in the introduction, you are ranked high on all these lists of greatest guitarists ever, and as we just heard, you do some extended guitar playing on this record. Mm-hmm. Has your style of guitar playing evolved over the years? Do you play now in 2013 the same way you did in 1973?
Well, hopefully I've got better. I think the style is kind of similar. Yeah, you know, I play this kind of Celtic influenced rock and roll guitar. So it's not very bluesy, but it's more sort of Celtic, which is, you know, a different thing, I think. And probably know more now. You know, I know more about harmony and stuff. So probably the actual notes are different.
That is interesting that you say Celtic influence. That, in a word, I guess, is what distinguishes you from your elder contemporaries like the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, you know, the Rolling Stones that, you know, fell in love with the blues and R&B, and that was their model. That's what they wanted to do. You know, there's only a few Stones songs that reflect
English.
Yeah, UK society. Yeah, you know, yeah. Mother's Little Helper, maybe. You know, there's some Kinks songs, there's some Beatles songs that reflect more the, you know, British experience. Back in Fairport, you know, we wanted to go back to the roots of the traditional style and really revive that.
And that's your story, and you're sticking to it.
That's my story. I'm sticking to it. I'm not changing a word.
Can we hear another song from the new album?
Certainly.
And what is this?
This is called Stony Ground.
One,
That's Richard Thompson playing Stony Ground off his new album, Electric, which proving the point you were just making earlier about the folk tradition. This is this funny, bleak, comic British story of an old man lusting after a girl and gets beat up.
Yeah. If I played it acoustic, it would just sound like a sort of traditional song.
Really?
Yeah. And I like this song because it's about sort of lusting old people, you know. And
Which you can feel.
Well, I can.
I mean, I'm saying these days, that would be a different thing sung by a 23-year-old.
Yeah, you know, but you know, some of our more senior bands kind of sort of perpetuate the myth that they're eternal teenagers. But I sort of like the idea of getting older and writing about, you know, older things, you know, and we're still randy old bastards, you know.
There you go.
Yep.
That's the song of the randy old bastard who gets punished for it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that's not a personal story.
Not yet. Coming soon.
So on this lovely new album, hard-driving new album, Electric, you end with two very, very acoustic tunes.
Yeah. That's just to remind the listeners who I really am. I don't know. It just seems a nice way to finish the record by kind of tailing off into this more reflective mood anyway, rather than, you know, hitting them all the way to the end. It's nice to just have some reflection.
And indeed, you show your generational roots by regarding it as an album that ends with these two songs, as though people will listen from song track one to track 10.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. If they want to, I'd be very grateful if they come on that journey with us, you know. I still like albums. I still like collections. I still like, you know, collections of poetry rather than, you know, one poem. I like to kind of read, you know, 15 poems, 16 uh-huh. poems that are written in a certain time period. And I feel the same about albums. I like that kind of unity that you get mm-hmm. with albums.
It's such a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thank you.
And a special thanks for effectively being our in-studio house band for today's show. How about one more instrumental piece to take us out for the day?
Okay, here we go.
One, two, three.
That is just about it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. You can see a video of Richard Thompson performing here today and listen to all the songs he played for us at studio360.org. And don't forget about our new extra credit challenge. With your help as composers, we're going to be remixing Spring with bird songs. All the details are available at studio360.org. And even if you're not up for making music, go listen to the birds. I guarantee they'll make you happy. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Posey Gruner,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Ruth Samuelson.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, sometimes movies about science hit a little too close to home.
Watching Gwyneth Paltrow going into a seizure from a viral infection and then having a pathologist cut her skull open, that's pretty gutsy.
Our viruses, ourselves. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.